This is Mae Brussel, and this is the second half of tape number 854, April 25th, 1988. Just quickly getting back to the Wall Street Journal story, near totalitarian IRS, referred to the case of Shirley Lojeski of Pennsylvania. She owed the government no back taxes. She had committed no crime. The IRS seized her bank account without warning as part of an enforcement action it was taking against her boyfriend. They suspected the boyfriend might be funneling money through her account, which he wasn't. Only a small fraction of the $247,000 that paid the IRS had been owed. She didn't get any of her money back till 4 months after the case was settled. By that time, she nearly went bankrupt. The government, the IRS, ordered her bank account seized. The man who did it got a promotion, and the promotion is key to this story I'm also referring to that we'll share from Barron's. And Mrs. Lojeski got a bill for $30,000 in legal fees, and the article says another taxpayer was harassed over a tax he already paid, and even after the service conceded he had paid it, it filed a lien against his house. And this article says that the Congress is now actually having a bill to stop the IRS and have protection for the citizens. The IRS has increased its power, of course, under Reagan. It has received additional manpower, and it is unwatched, unchecked by Congress, and horror stories continue. The taxpayer's rights, his or hers, to tax proceedings are totally ignored, and now Congress wants a bill that would protect people, that would give them a notice that the IRS is coming, that the legislation would be extended from 10 to 30 days in the notice period, and that they have to give taxpayers some notice before they seize the property, and that you would be able to sue the IRS for damages to legally protect yourself if you haven't done anything wrong. So this bill is before the Congress right now. Hopefully it'll pass, and of course the IRS opposes it. And now to this amazing story. One of the judges, as I say, Judge George Basin, was fired. Tony Pesutto, the whistleblower, was fired and taken off his job. Lee Ratner, an attorney in Washington, D.C., was fired from his law firm. Six people from the Justice Department resigned. One was promoted out of all this, who was an active participant in this horrible story. Lowell Jensen became a judge in California, and he's, of course, one of the people I've talked about for years as part of the Reagan Mafia. Dangerous person. And IBM was a winner. They acquired the company Inslaw. And, of course, I referred, and we'll go back to it in a few moments, last week's broadcast, I was talking about Padachevsky's Play Network, where there are no nations. There's just companies, including AT&T and IBM. Well, IBM acquired the company that the Justice Department had contracted with and forced to go bankrupt, and it was gobbled up by IBM. The corporations are eating, swallowing, gulping the little small companies. They force them out of business and are ready to grab them. It is a real live game called Catch the Company. Now, Inslaw is being taken over by IBM. IBM was a software company, a small software company, and their trouble began in 1982 when they got a $10 million contract with the Justice Department. Ronald Reagan was sworn in 1981, and by 1982, he had his muscles and his hands into the Justice Department. The founder of the company, his name is Bill Hamilton, and the Justice Department brought the prosecutor's management in. They bought what is called the Prosecutor's Management Information System. That was his system into the computer. It spells down, it's broken down to PROMIS, Prosecutor Management Information System, PROMIS. If I refer to PROMIS, that's the computer system that the Justice Department bought, and Mr. Hamilton had spent his life, most of his life, and his life savings building this system, which he was able to sell to the Justice Department in 1982. Then things took a mysterious turn. Payments were withheld from the Justice Department. They bought the system, and he hired people then to start producing, and payments started stopping coming in for what he was already working on. There were contract disputes that people took up that he didn't understand that began to be multiplied like agent provocateurs in the system. There were threats that were made and accelerated, and he didn't know what was happening to him or why, after working all his life, making a thing which worked, selling it to the great United States Justice Department, and things were going wrong. And all of a sudden, the cash flow stopped coming in, and it was shriveling. And by 1985, he had 3 years of working, trying to put this together for the Justice Department. By 1985, his place was in shambles financially. I might tell you another part of the punchline, and we'll get to it, that there recently was a $6.1 million settlement by the federal government that you taxpayers paid for his harassment that you didn't do, that Meese did, and Ronald Reagan's team did, Lowell Jensen and Meese and that group, and others that I'll mention. But there's a $6.1 million that he already got as a settlement. And the judge, though, was fired from the case for siding with him. And there may be a $25 million payment settlement to him, but that's why the one judge was fired and the new judge brought on. And I can see now why Judge Bork wanted to be in the Supreme Court so desperately with his mindset on these things. But they went into financial shambles, and Bill Hamilton ended up in a bankruptcy court, which he had never done or dreamt he was going to have to do. And the federal judge who handed down this astonishing ruling in 1987, as I say, was favoring Mr. Bill Hamilton and his problems, then was removed. The judge was Judge George Basin, who sided with Mr. Hamilton in this case. And he found, his conclusions were, and he stated in the court and so forth, was that the Justice Department, now this is the Justice Department, had purposely propelled Inslaw, had on purpose caused its bankruptcy in an effort, he said, to steal its Promis software through trickery, fraud, and deceit. That's what the judge said, that the Justice Department did. On February the 2nd, 1988, Judge Basin ordered the Department of Justice to pay Inslaw in licensing fees and $1 million in legal fees. The punitive damage may run as high as $25 million. The trial testimony revealed an unexplained series of coincidences around the case. The justice appointed a man named C. Madison Brewer, whose nickname is Brick. We'll refer to him as Brick Brewer. Was the man to be in charge to oversee the Inslaw contract. The contract was bought, as I say, in 1982, and Mr. Brewer was in charge of the contract in the Justice Department. But Brewer had worked for Mr. Hamilton and had been fired by him, and it turned out that the Justice Department and the people working there, coming from the Alameda Mafia that I had cited way back when Meese was getting his confirmation hearings in March of 84, 4 years ago. They bought it because they needed the material. Then they squeezed the man out so they could steal what he had. And the person in charge of squeezing him out was a man who had been fired by Hamilton. He fired him in May of 1976. That was 5 years before the contract. And according to the judge, this Brewer was filled with hatred, described by Judge Brewer as consumed with hatred towards his former employer, and they couldn't figure out why the Justice Department picked the man to administer the contract who was filled with hatred towards Hamilton. And, of course, the answer, you'll find, is in the dollars. And the question asked in the article, why did the Justice Department condone a vendetta against a small private company? Judge Brewer wanted to know. In November of 86, Judge Basin rejected the Justice Department motion to liquidate. They didn't want him just in bankruptcy. The Justice Department wanted it liquidated completely, and then, as I say, the vultures would take the body. 1 month later, Judge Basin learned that he would not be reappointed to the bench. This is December of 86. In the past 4 years, only four of 136 federal bankruptcy judges who was seeking reappointment have been turned down. Judge Basin was replaced by S. Martin Teel, T-E-E-L, a Justice Department attorney who wanted Inslaw liquidated and had been turned down at the time. So the new judge is one who wants the company liquidated. The one who was removed didn't want it liquidated. Now the Justice Department, according to former Judge Basin, can make the important decision on the punitive damages, which will probably be zero. For a while, Judge Teel has recused himself from the case. The Justice Department is appealing, and the Inslaw versus USA hangs in limbo. Now, a gentleman named Tony Pasciuto, P-A-S-C-I-U-T-O, became the Justice Department whistleblower. He felt very badly about what was happening, and now he was waiting for a verdict on his 21-year career. Worked with the government 21 years and finally was given walking papers if he never told anybody what happened and they'd give him a recommendation because he was ready to sue the government. 2 weeks ago, he revealed for Barron's Magazine how the payments for Inslaw were treated and sabotaged. He said the Justice Department colleague responsible for paying the contractor bills out of the Justice Department put them in three piles. One pile was paid right away. Next pile was paid when he got around to it. The third pile was a drawer with invoices, and it said, "These may never get paid. If you're on the bad list, you go in the drawer." Inslaw is on the bad list. Now, think about these implications, and I'm going slow on this, because is this the mafia? A redundant question. Of course it is. The Justice Department hires a person who has the best computer for what they're doing and then takes the invoices and lets him hire people and start producing what they ordered and tells the others we're not going to pay him anything for it. So the invoices went into drawer three, and the Justice Department that should be investigating people who have a contract for selling or producing and don't come through with it, you know, and force another person out of business by holding up that money, the Justice Department's supposed to be prosecuting. But this Justice Department under Reagan and Meese had a drawer for people they contracted for jobs and didn't pay until they squeezed them and, you know, forced them to bleed. Cornelius Blackshear, a federal judge and former U.S. trustee who's based in New York City, worked with Tony Pasciuto, the whistleblower, and Pasciuto told him that the Justice Department, his Justice Department superior in Washington, was pressuring him to send someone to Washington, D.C. and help liquidate the company that the Justice Department had hired to do their computer work. And Washington wanted to make sure that this job was done. And when the Inslaw lawyers deposed Blackshear, he confirmed the story. But when Judge Blackshear went back on, this is the judge who worked with Tony Pasciuto, when the judge went on, he recanted his story and was forced to change his story, forced a federal judge to change his story under oath. 1 hour after Tony Pasciuto was subpoenaed to testify, the testimony would come up, and a few weeks later, he received a subpoena on this matter. His superiors, who knew he would like to be moving to Albany, New York, offered him a long-awaited transfer in Albany, and this was the bait that they were giving him. And he said he felt scared that he was out there all alone. He bought a home in Albany, and he didn't know what else to do, so he changed his story on the stand. Later, he came back and was punished for supporting Mr. Hamilton and what happened to him. But he changed his story on the stand, and the Justice Department forces a judge or a witness, baits them with a home, and when they have the payments and so forth, they will lie on the stand. So the Justice Department is forcing their witnesses to lie. He said he was close to tears when he was forced to recant on the stand, just like the judge. And then Judge Basin recalled that Mr. Pasciuto seemed to be basically honest. He was caught up amongst a gang of very tough people, and he didn't know what to do. Now, what are your choices in the Justice Department? The judge and the attorneys told him to lie, that he was among a gang of tough people. The Justice Department shouldn't be filled with the people threatening to kill you or break your job or whatever, but that's exactly what they are, a gang of thugs. After the testimony, Pasciuto met Judge Blackshear at a party, and he said, "I'm sorry." He apologized. Mr. Pasciuto, the man who changed his testimony, he said, "I'm sorry, but the people from Washington and the U.S. Attorney's Office confuse me. I thought by changing my story, I would hurt less people." So there were threats, of course, and the criteria is I can screw over Bill Hamilton and the people he hired and force them to lose their jobs and go bankrupt at that computer company, because otherwise people in the Justice Department will be hurt, and I didn't want to hurt the people in the Justice Department by getting them in trouble. And then his punishment came anyway. After he testified in court, the Justice Department told him, sorry, the procedure has changed. You can't be transferred to Albany. So he had a home in Albany that he was getting ready to move to, and began to have to commute from Washington to Albany to get rid of them because of the financial burden, and had to worry that work that out. That was one of his punishments. In April of 1988, Deputy Attorney General Arnold Burns and B. Boykin Rose, B-O-Y-K-I-N, left the Justice Department. Actually, it was March 30th, April the 1st, that six people left the Justice Department, and it appeared that they were leaving because of the Edwin Meese affair. But this article says it wasn't because of that at all. It was T. Boykin Rose, the aide to the Deputy Attorney General, Arnold Burns, who wrote a letter to Deputy Attorney General when he was in the office together. His aide wrote to his boss and recommended that they fire whistleblower Tony Pesciuto and get rid of them. Now, when Meese rewarded Lowell Jensen with a lifetime judgeship in California, the Deputy Attorney General became Arnold Burns. And Arnold Burns, the man who left the Justice Department, it turns out this last March, was no a hero protesting the sleaziness of Edwin Meese. He was caught up in the sleaze of Edwin Meese and evidently forced to leave. This article in Barron's came out April the 4th, and they left the Justice Department March 30th, so they probably got wind, because this very detailed article wasn't written in one day. They got wind that all six of them that left were heavily involved in this whole scandal, and that's why they left the Justice Department. And this article goes on to say that T. Boykin Rose, one of the people who resigned, and his boss Arnold Burns both wanted Pesciuto fired for helping Mr. Hamilton find out what came down on him and how it happened. But his problems continued, the article said, hanging on to a new home he bought. And he began to say, I'm like under house arrest. He didn't know what to do. He was waiting to end his 21-year career in the government service. His boss, Thomas Stanton, he said, can't fire me, but Deputy Attorney General Arnold Burns will fire me. And how does it feel when you know that the Deputy Attorney General wants to destroy a GS, Government Service 15. It's a scare. It scares me to death. And the article says, last week, referring to March the 30th, the dissidents left the Justice Department, led by Deputy Attorney General Arnold Burns. There are two disquieting questions about this that are in the article. Why did the U.S. Department want to liquidate Hamilton Software Company after signing a contract with him that they thought they needed? And how did the cover-up of this scheme continue to destroy Insula? And as I say, these top six officials who left, one was Deputy Attorney General Arnold Burns, the other was William Weld, head of criminal division, who's also involved in the Iran-Contra scandals with Faith Whittlesley. I haven't even done the Weld connections to that. Trott, Stephen Trott, who became a judge. Reagan has promoted Stanley Sporkin and Lowell Jensen, and he's made judges out of people, Mr. Silberman, who was involved in the Iran hostage rescue failure, the arms to Iran, and so forth. And William Buckley, the intelligence community, Sporkin and Buckley of the CIA, he's making judges of these people to have them in key positions when his administration is over. Mark Robinson left, and Jane Serene, those were William Weld's aides. And Weld is also tied into the scandal of LaRouche and North, the FBI spying on Lyndon LaRouche with Oliver North and Secord and Peregrine Corporation. So they got out of the Justice Department March 30th, but they didn't go out clean. They ran, and Burns' aides, Randy Levine and Boykin Rose, left the Justice Department. When they left, the government had already agreed for a settlement to Mr. Hamilton and possibly 25,000 more when these people resign. Now, according to Barron, their exodus represents the climax, and this is getting into the nitty-gritty, the climax of a much larger subterranean game of musical chairs that has been going on in the Justice Department for the past 18 months. Now, this is a complicated article. I've got 16 pages, and I'm on page 2 of my outline. So bear with me, because the subterranean gets deeper, and it could be the whole computerized Fourth Reich under the computer program called The Eagle. And there's so many implications here, but Behrens' author takes you right into those deep levels, and she says, according to Behrens, their exodus represents, those six, the climax to a larger subterranean game of musical chairs going on in the Justice Department for the past 18 months. And so I looked at my calendar to see what was happening 18 months ago. They referred to them as moles. What happened was October 86, just 18 months ago, Eugene Hasenfuss landed in Nicaragua. And prior to that, Oliver North was suspected of arming the Contras against the Boland Amendment. If you saw in the newspaper today, the FBI said Ollie North lied, and he said his dog was poisoned and his tires were slashed, and he was naming persons that he wanted the Justice Department to look into and harass. And as they looked into it, they discovered that North was involved with arms to the Contras and that he was lying about the incidents that the dog died of cancer and the tires weren't slashed. But he wanted to use the federal agencies to go against his enemies. But the Justice Department was aware at that time, so they were dealing with something worse than the opening into the Watergate Hotel by the Republicans at time of Watergate. And Meese and the White House didn't want another Watergate or a Senator Frank Church committee in the opening up of all their activities. So what they did was they seasoned and the little things that they were cooking in the Justice Department by placing moles heavily into every agency where investigations could be sabotaged into the illegal activities of the administration of Richard Nixon, going from 1980, stealing the election papers or for arming the Contras, etc., etc. In 1986, at this time, in October, William Casey was being blackmailed by Mr. Furmark and Khashoggi. They wanted their $10 million loan back and found out it was diverted from the profit of the Iran arms down to the bank account of Willard Zucker, their pal. And in November 86, Meese had come forward because the Lebanon newspaper talked about the Iran weapons. And the Christic Institute filed a suit in May of 86. And it's just at this time period that when the Christic Institute filed their suit about La Penca bombings to identify the secret team, that 50, 60, maybe 100 or 200 moles now are carefully placed into the Justice Department. And this article goes into the moles. And also, the paper this morning refers to the reason Ollie North lied was he wanted to get to the Christic Institute and harass Danny Sheehan and turn the FBI against them instead of investigating North and his buddies. So what they refer to as a subterranean game of musical chairs for the past 18 months is tied into those very events of Danny Sheehan hitting upon that secret team and the Iran-Contra affair beginning to break open. Now, the article says the moles were carefully placed in the Justice Department. One insider in the Justice Department said, I know of at least 50 or 60 career employees who've been reassigned or forced out. Some have been forced out, others given other jobs. The department is using background computer checks in order to manufacture reasons for forcing employees to leave. Now, think of that implication in this article. The government has employees that have been the federal government, FBI, is using computers. And think of Western Goals, that company that was taking information from the Reagan and Meese administration and probably from 49 other governors and police departments in major cities and major states around the country. Western Goals run by John Reese and Larry McDonald. When Larry McDonald was killed in September of 83, it went to Carl Spitz Channel. On the board are people like Admiral Moore, John Singlob, John Patton III, so George Patton III, and so forth. But the computers are being used by the Justice Department to check or manufacture a reason to force employees in the Justice Department manufacture a reason to fire people so they can be replaced with moles by using the computers, going back to the Vietnam War, to the pro-abortion, etc., etc. And the Behrens article says they're trying to find out or force openings for political appointees that they want. They are buried in what we call moles into the Justice Department. They bury the moles so the next administration can't find them. Go to your library and copy Behrens, April the 4th, 1988. On their second page of this, they get into the moles. Now, let's let me get off the article for 1 second to get into facts. Fact one, I have fact 13 of them. In 1943 to 45, 100,000 Liebers born or more were raised by the Reich to continue a thousand-year Reich. Where are they now? Fact two, they're 40 and 45 years old now. They were given for adoption to other families to be raised by the Gestapo, etc., etc. Are these the kind of young people that go into the AT&T now and have important voices on voting against minority jobs? Where are these people? What countries? Fact three, that we know that people such as Richard Pipes from Hungary have changed their names. He's on the National Security Council. His name isn't Pipes. He's anti-Soviet Union or peace or anything else except warfare state. And an example is the way people have changed their names to Americanize them. We know that Sven Kramer didn't change his name. He was brought up in Nazi Germany as an infant and brought to this country. And nobody connects them to Fritz Kramer and the National Security Council. Who is Fritz? And what are the decisions behind the mentality to manufacture reasons to get people out of office so you make political appointees in the Justice Department that can't be found? I won't run down the 13 facts. I've had them on the program before, but they have to do from World War II up to the present, where these people have worked inside our government. Now, the plan, according to the Justice Department insider, the plan is to place the moles, which are political appointees, then move them into GS, which is government service jobs, where it looks like they work their way up, and they're not government long government employees, but they look like that. And they're normally held by career government employees, and the career ones are being moved out. And this article says it will take the next administration at least 2 years to figure out who are the real career employees or the career employees that were pushed out based upon these FBI computers run by William Webster, who is now the CIA director, and who are the political appointees that have been dropped into their slots of the career employees. In the meantime, according to Behrens, the moles are in place, and they will have the historical knowledge of how the organization works, and everyone else will be gone. Now, our time is almost over for this hour, so I want to leave you. I'm building up to who bankrupted this company and how it unraveled. And, of course, the man who bankrupted was none other than this Dr. Brian, who I talked about 4 years ago at the time of the Meese hearings, and I've updated it. Dr. Earl Brian, who worked with Edwin Meese and Ronald Reagan in California. He owns a company called Hadron Incorporated that I had on the air. This was program 642, March 26, 1984. The president of Hadron is Dominic Leite. And Dominic Leite telephoned Mr. Bill Hamilton after he got his contract. And this is very sinister. He gets the contract in 1982 in the Justice. And then in 1983, the president of Hadron, owned by Meese and Reagan's crony, and involved with Mrs. Meese's money and funding when they came to Washington and things even more sinister, picks up the phone and asks, Mr. Hamilton, will you sell Inslaw? And Hamilton said no. And he's trying to think back on what happened to him, how, besides having the man who he had fired in charge of the contract then, how this happened. And he remembers this telephone call, and the man says, well, I know people high up in government. If you don't sell me your company, I know people high up. So it was Edwin Meese and Lowell Jensen and Ronald Reagan's team from Alameda that began the decline to get him into liquidation, not just bankruptcy, break his back, because when he had a good thing, they couldn't take it over by offering a price. Now, the story in Barron's, just to continue, and next week I'll get into Earl Brian and the organizations that he has in biotechnology, Infotechnology, Zonix, corporations that I had before on the air, and Acumedics. And I believe Acumedics could have been the seed money in 1970 when Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger were moving the German biological warfare out of Fort Detrick and moving another group in, and according to the book The Higher Form of Killing and the New York Times articles, worked with Litton Industry, the organization that put the police, military, junta, Nazis into Greece, and this could have possibly been the seed money for the disease AIDS. It's not a very short distance from what Dr. O'Brien was in and Otto von Bolschwing with his links to Warner Lambert and Elmer Bops, and I've had many broadcasts and references to the medical cancer connections to the Reagan administration. There isn't enough time on this broadcast, and I'm going to be doing maybe all next week on this particular company because it's very, very important. Instead of just updating some of the current news, maybe get the rest of it on tape number 855. But I think you have a pretty good background now of how the Justice Department had made its mind up. When they contracted, they got the best computer program they wanted, and then they were going to own it. If they didn't own it, they would liquidate it and buy it in that state, break the backs and careers of an attorney, a judge, force another judge to lie, use computers and moles to take over the Justice Department. It's all here, and as they summarize in this article, it's not a play or a movie or fiction. It's all here, and as the judge says, it's scary. And it is scary because it seems a good overview of the things I've tried to share with you through the years. So I will do most of this next week, even if you get the article at the library, and I hope you do. I'll share it with you and go over the implications of the details because they are really very horrendous.